This Week in Radio Tech is supported by the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource at thebdr.net, and also by Violet Microphones at violetusa.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt.
You let some hippies bribe their congressman with liquor and free political ads, and the next thing you know, they're standing on your third adjacent.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Dad?
All your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business,
or in a choice hotel in a distant land,
this is Kirk Harnack.
We rounded up the usual suspects at an Irish pub on the Upper West Side. Plus, we get a surprise visit from Larry Fuzz.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
And welcome in to This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. Glad you're along with us. This is the show that talks about radio technology, anything from the microphone to the antenna at the top of the tower, and sometimes the flashing light on top of that. Plus, we talk about radio receivers, what's new in technology, digital radio, even some shortwave radio from time to time. We tell you how to do the easy stuff, and we talk about the difficult stuff. And joining me on the show today, our erstwhile friend, Thomas Ray III from New York City. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Kirk, and I swear that it was the light that was flashing on top of the tower. Not
it
me.
Okay. Is your light flashing now, Tom?
Well, when I passed them, when I drove through the Lincoln Tunnel, yes.
You saw lights in the Lincoln Tunnel?
Oh, no, I saw my power lights when I came out of the Lincoln Tunnel.
Oh, okay. All right. Another guy who has a few tower lights, Chris Tobin, is with us. Hi, Chris.
Good evening. How's everybody?
Good. And you are in Manhattan, yeah?
Yes, I am. Yes, it is raining, and the roads are slick, and the cars are moving very slowly.
And it's raining here in Nashville, too. I should disclaim, Tom is the director of engineering for Buckley Broadcasting, so that's his perspective on life.
And I work through WOR in New York on a normal basis.
And Chris Tobin normally works where?
CBS Radio. This is the CBS Radio cluster in New York City. It's six radio stations.
That is a cluster.
Oh, it is. Three AMs and three FMs, all 50,000-watt stations.
And the guy from Milwaukee whose tower light flashes only six times per minute, it's Chris Tarr.
That's right, from Chris in Manhattan to Chris in the cornfields. Here I am.
Hi, Chris. Glad to have you along. How are things in Wisconsin?
Things in Wisconsin are great. You know, of course, there's beer and brats everywhere, so how can it be, you know, not great?
Chris, you're the engineering director there in Milwaukee for Entercom, yeah?
Yep, three radio stations in Milwaukee and three radio stations in Madison, Wisconsin.
We'll do everybody's websites at the end of the broadcast, so if you want to read more about Tom Ray, Chris Tobin, or Chris Tarr, just stay tuned. We'll hope you'll stay tuned for the entire time. Later on in the show, we have a special guest who's going to join us by the old technology known as a telephone. And he's going to give us a little bit of insight on one of our topics. And in fact, let's talk briefly about this topic right now. It is a bill that is going to be before Congress. It's called H.R. 1147. This is also known as the Local Community Radio Act of 2009. And essentially, this bill, if we look that up online, and I had it here, here we go. There's a website you can go to, opencongress.org. Or you can just Google H.R. 1147 and probably find it as well. What this bill appears to do is it's supposed to make room for more radio stations on the dial, specifically more low-power FM stations. That's LPFM stations. These stations are typically, I think, 10 watts or 100 watts, depending on where they are and how much area they're supposed to cover. And, you know, there's a number of LPFMs across the country now. I personally have no idea how well some of them are doing. Probably a few are doing quite well, and some are probably now a burden to the people who originally applied for them. The bill that's before Congress, it's out of committee now and headed into Congress for a vote at some point. And this bill directs the Federal Communications Commission to modify its rules to eliminate what we call third adjacent minimum distance separation between low-power stations and three different classes of other stations: full service, FM stations, FM translator stations, and FM booster stations. So that's the setup for this brief part of our discussion. Larry Fuss later on in the hour will come in with a few choice comments of his own about this notion. And there are a lot of people, you know, it's very, very passionate arguments on either side of this. So, gentlemen, let me open it up and see if we have thoughts on either the technical or the social aspects of passing this bill and letting a few more stations come on the air.
No, I think kind of on the fence. Oh, go ahead, Chris.
I'm sorry. Socially, I don't know if you can really this. Everybody wants to be heard, you know, local radio and television these days. But I just don't see it really making a difference for folks. You already have rules that help the community services, the what do you call it, the Part 15 that real estate places will use and churches and whatnot, and they serve their communities very well within that area. To go this far, I'm not sure if it'll really help at all. That's just my opinion. Tom?
You know, from a technical standpoint, I mean, I'm kind of on the fence about the third adjacent thing because the newer radios, I mean, let's face it, they've got better front ends than the older radio sets do, but I don't know. There could be some potential for some issues there on the social aspect. Yeah, I think you're right. I don't know what it would do, and if they're going to be looking for any local businesses and such to support these stations. There's only so much of the pie that can go around. I mean, you know, and in many of our markets, it's already pretty thin.
It's very good, actually, in most markets.
You know, my feeling on it is, and I feel pretty strongly about it. I really like the idea of it. I think it's a great idea. I think it's the spirit as well. But if you look back on some of these LPFMs and how poorly designed or built they were and how they weren't really following the licenses that were given to them, there's a fine for station in LPFM down in Texas because it was running overpowered. It used a multiple bay antenna several hundred feet up. You know, it was just way overpowered for what it was supposed to be. I have one in the area here that, you know, you're lucky if it, you know, there's a legal ID. There's no contact information on how to find the public file for this radio station. So, you know, I like the idea. The problem is that there needs to be, if somebody's going to be a licensee, a group or whatever, there has to be some way to, you know, ensure that these people are going to operate legally. We take away this third adjacent channel protection. You know, I'm not so much against that, but you know, we need to find some way to make sure that these things are built the way they're supposed to be built to ensure that there's not going to be any problems.
Let's explain for some listeners who don't know what the third adjacency thing is. If you have a station, let's say a licensed commercial radio station on, let's say, 99.1 FM, the third adjacent channel to 99.1 would be, 99.3 would be the first adjacent, and 99.5 would be the second adjacent. And so 99.7 would be the third adjacent, and then going down the dial in the other direction, it would be what 98.5. Did I get that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So yes. So it's three channels away is the third adjacent. And guys, the reason that we have the rules we do now that separate radio stations in terms of distance from each other and space on the dial is so that radios, typical, you know, $10, $20, $50, $100 consumer radios, will work. So you can tune in one station and not hear two stations at the same time, or not hear a degraded signal from the station that you want to hear because of another station that's too close by. And generally, I think in the U.S., this works pretty well. Of course, there are people who claim that, oh, there's so much extra space on the dial that we could fit hundreds of radio stations in here. Well, okay, I got two beefs with that. No, you actually couldn't. I mean, even these little FM transmitters for iPods cause problems, especially to public radio stations that are licensed in the lower part of the FM band. And so people go and buy their little FM transmitters to go on with their maybe their satellite radio or maybe with their iPod. And we've had cases of people transmitting the Howard Stern show from satellite over some some area, and a number of other people being able to pick it up, or it actually interfering with a public radio station or a religious radio station that's down in that part of the dial. And I guess my other problem with this is if these LPFM stations are required to follow the same rules as the rest of us commercial broadcasters, well, okay. But if they're not required to follow the same rules as in terms of public safety and EAS equipment And if not having an operator on duty, at least having the equipment to work properly the whole time. And then all the logging requirements that there are, and being at the proper frequency and the proper power, and having a designated chief operator and all that kind of thing. We got to make sure that you know, if these guys want to come play in the sandbox, they got to follow the same rules.
See, and that's the rub with me is, you know, I agree completely with Tom that, you know, with today's radio, is really the third adjacent thing isn't real significant. If you are, you know, if your radio station is well engineered and well built and follows, you know, the rules, there really shouldn't be a lot of problem. But, you know, I think in a case where, we're kind of handing the keys over to, you know, smaller groups, which I don't have a problem with, but generally they're not going to have the resources to, you know, do the real high quality engineering studies and things like that. I think in some cases you almost need to have a little more restriction on that because of the potential there that could happen by inexperienced people building these things.
Well, never mind that, but how about maintenance once the thing's on? I mean, they're not going to be able to hire anybody with any real skills to to come out and take care of the place. And, you know, if they don't have a full-time guy hanging around to look after things, and, you know, chances are a lot of these people aren't going to be technical in nature. I mean, that opens the door for a lot of problems.
What happens if your audio processor blows up and you're splattering all over the place? And
Processor? You mean these LPFMs have an audio processor?
Exactly. I mean, you know, those are the things.
Two dials
goes to 11.
Right, you know, and that concerns me when you eliminate that protection.
Well, I'm in this last couple of minutes, we're having some fun at the expense of those who have operated LPFMs poorly, and certainly there have been plenty of those. Now I know there's plenty that have been built okay and follow the rules and are serving a community where, let's say, a Class A FM station, you know, 3,000 or 6,000 watts, for some reason wouldn't fit in, but a community is otherwise underserved. So my impression is a lot of people who want to do an LPFM want to do this out of a labor of love. I don't think they're allowed to make money at this. They're allowed to have underwriters, but not radio ads. And so this has got to be a labor of love. What happens when the love runs out?
Yeah, well, you know, and I've been into some of these facilities. They're beautiful. They've done a great job, and the community supports them. And I think that's wonderful. I think that's great. But, you know, there's, you know, again, we go back to how do we ensure that across the board? And, you know, when we eliminate these third adjacent protections, you know, it's kind of a gamble, I think.
Well, hey, we'll revisit this later in the show as Larry Fuss will be joining us in a little while. And Larry has some interesting context on this as well, because actually, Larry and I own some radio stations together. And we also own some translators, too, and have some parties that own translators that rebroadcast our station. So yeah, we've got thoughts about this. Well, moving on, we are going to talk about an interesting subject as we're getting into the winter months, when the weather can get really disastrous. We can have ice on the power lines and the power can go out, and people can't get to their jobs, and yet people need the radio because they need to hear where to get help, or what the weather's going to be, or when is this disaster going to be over with. And so let's turn our attention to disaster recovery. Chris Tobin suggested this topic, and Chris, I guess you guys at CBS Radio in New York City are especially concerned about making sure you're on the air in any kind of weather.
Oh, yes. Weather, natural disasters, and man-made disasters. I recently attended NBC training, nuclear, biological, chemical disaster practice. And during the courses, I was listening to the instructors talk about what to prepare and how to prepare and what to watch out for and what to think about, or how to think about what to do, the what-if scenario. And it was interesting. He gave an example, and one of our studios at one time was located just across the street from Carnegie Hall. And he said, you know, if you're in Midtown Manhattan and a chemical truck is driving through, which can very well be the case, tips over, starts leaking chlorine gas. Chlorine gas is toxic, as we know, could easily require a shutdown of 6 or 7 city blocks square right away. And he says, if your building is in that zone, what do you do? If you're told to leave, or do you have to stay because it stays low to the ground? So you may be in a high rise. They may tell you to stay indoors, keep the windows closed, and wait for the authorities to explain what to do. And I thought about that. I was like, wow, that would be interesting. We suddenly now can't go anywhere, and we can't implement anything we're doing if we're stuck in a building. Or if we're told we have to leave the building, then what do you do? So it was not only just rain, hurricanes, tornadoes, or anything else. It was just something as simple as a truck driving down the road and, boop, falling over.
Uh-huh.
So, So you, maybe, when I mentioned the broadcast continuity of disaster recovery for this topic, I was hoping we could just touch on the fact that what if a vehicle drives into you, a fire starts in the building that you're in because you happen to have three restaurants on the ground floor, like we do. which we did have a kitchen fire once, and thank goodness we were high enough in the building, and the fire department arrived and said, "You're okay. The fire is contained, and the smoke is being evacuated through some vents and whatnot. You should be fine, but just know that we may have to come up and tell you to evacuate." Of course, our 24-hour news operation sitting there going, "Really? Let's start calling a few folks and get to our backup site now."
Oh,
yeah. So it wasn't even a concern of rain or hurricanes. It was literally a fire in the kitchen.
So what are you guys doing in response to what you learned at this seminar?
Okay. Well, what we've done is at our transmitter sites, we have set up our file servers to back up all of our commercials, and in the case of the music stations, music libraries. We've put together a remote access to the transmitter site, a remote access kit. So basically the PD or jock or whomever has been designated during a time of disaster can remote in to the remote to transmitter site, activate the system from there, switch studio control to that location, and now play the log that's currently on the air, commercials, everything else, from that spot, dialing in an ISDN, their microphone. ISDN folks, we have some folks at home with ISDN codecs and remote access. Also, they can drive to the transmitter site. We have a small studio we can set up. What we've also done is we have a couple of sister stations in the market that have off-site studios outside of our main building, and there we have backup facilities also replicating our day-to-day operations. So in the case of the all-news station, all of our news content, all the scripts and everything we do is literally being replicated to the transmitter site, to our back off-site studios, and to three different servers within the building so we can remote access. If we had to evacuate, we could still remote into the building and conduct business.
Wow. That's a lot of planning.
That's,
yeah.
It's still, and it's ongoing. The one thing they stress in this training course was just because you've implemented it doesn't mean you stop. You have to keep, thinking, revisiting it every couple of weeks and say, what if now? And how are we doing? Also, they recommend at least monthly, minimum once a month, test it. Test your backups, as we all know, for transmitter maintenance. But, it's interesting when you go to say, okay, we're going to test the backup today and just pull the plug on something and move. It's a different mindset. And I think we had, Tom, we had an SB meeting down at AT&T, did we not?
Yeah, we did.
And they discussed...
It was a couple of years ago, yeah.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, AT&T's Global Network Operations Center in New Jersey, they have two locations, the one that everybody sees and loves and the pictures are always on TV. Then they have a second one that's a mirror image. And the gentleman who runs the facility told us at this meeting, because we will randomly pick a day, make the phone calls to staffers who are designated as the backup go-to people and tell them you're starting your day at site B and we'll switch operations once you arrive. And they literally switch control to their backup, to their alternate site.
Huh.
And they just operate. I mean, literally, this is we're talking the global network. We're not talking AT&T long distance or, three statewide. We're talking the entire AT&T global network worldwide.
Yeah.
That's how they practice ensuring that their backup systems are functioning.
You said it's important to test your backup systems. Is it practical for CBS Radio, any of your stations, to go to that that level of testing?
Actually, it is, because we have different times of the day we could pick, weekends. All you need to do is about 2 hours, 3 hours. That's all. Just, run through your normal routine for 3 hours from your alternate site. You'll know right away if you've overlooked anything or if something's amiss. And you can always switch back. You don't evacuate your current site. You just say, okay, for the 3 hours on this day, the news anchors that normally are on this time, you'll continue operating from site A. We're going to bring in the weekend folks for a three-hour shift, and they're just going to go on the air from there, and then that's it. You can also operate in shadow mode, where you're not on the air, but you're operating in tandem as if you were. And what we do is we'll listen to the audio leaving that site, coming back on an ISDN at the transmitter site. So we'll have our transmitter guys listening to the incoming feed on ISDN, pipe back to us at the main site, and listen to it, make sure, yep, that's good, that's right, everything is in sync. Perfect, done. Just food for thought.
Well, in learning what you've learned about this, what's been the most surprising thing or the thing that shocked you, like, absolutely, we better do that, and we never thought of that before?
Switching the phone lines over. The studio lines.
Hmm.
nobody thought about that. It's like, okay, we're on the alternate site.
But the phone's not ringing.
Called, who's calling what number?
Yeah.
Well, they just called the number that's at the alternate site. Yeah. And did we give that number out to anyone? Oops. Things like that. That's the stuff that you overlook. The most obvious.
Yeah, yeah.
It was funny. We're all sitting on, oh, yeah, that's an interesting one. Okay, we do have all the numbers in place. We just forgot to tell everybody which ones to use.
Now, you and Tom Ray are both in New York City, but you have your operations are quite a bit different.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Tom, tell us about your operation and disaster preparedness.
Well, we're talk radio station is a little bit different than an all news operation. You know, we do run some syndicated programming. We actually originate two radio networks, so we do have a lot of in-house programming, and we do a lot of live stuff on the air too. Studio facility, we've got multiple studios and backup. We have four hot paths to the transmitter site at all times. That's both audio and data. We've got a generator at the studio location, and we've been at the studio location, I'm going to say, for about 4 years now. And over 4 years, we've had three cases where we came real close to having to evacuate for some reason. I mean, one day there was this mysterious smell in Manhattan, and we got a phone call, and they said, we may be telling you to evacuate.
Hmm.
The facility itself will run itself. If we had to get out, it'll run itself for, well, quite a while. But at the transmitter site, of course, we've got dual everything. We've got a backup generator there with 11 days of fuel. The studio's 2 days. We have a studio. Well, we're finishing up a studio at the transmitter site. We do have backup servers and our spots backed up at the transmitter site. We have phones at the transmitter site, so we can actually do talk shows. We've got television at the transmitter site. All of our satellite equipment's at the transmitter site, so we could get all of our news channels and everything else we need. So that's how we're backed up. Of course, in New York City, we tend to everybody tends to, you know, do overkill with backup because you don't want to be off the air.
Tom, your satellite uplinks. Maybe I missed that. Do you have more than one way to get your audio to your network you feed?
Yeah. Well, out of the studio facility, we've got two T1s that take separate paths once they leave the building through the city. We can go ISDN. And we're using Citadel / ABC for uplink. So we can ISDN it up to West End Avenue as well. We can also ISDN it directly out to Vernon Valley, where the actual uplink is. The uplink for the Citadel transponder, most people don't realize this, even though Citadel's in New York City, the uplink is out in New Jersey, out in a little area called Vernon Valley.
Yeah,
and if you in the middle of winter, if all of a sudden your satellite signal fades, it's probably because a real big snow cell just went over Vernon Valley.
Yeah.
Let me tell you,
that's
they get snow
really big.
Oh my God! But we can ISDN into there too if necessary, and all of us, you know, we all have separate paths. I mentioned at WR we've got different paths. I've got two fiber lines going into the transmitter. They both take different paths, and I know they do. They had a problem with some lines in the Lincoln Tunnel about a year ago, and we lost the one in the Lincoln Tunnel. I know exactly which circuit goes through the Lincoln Tunnel now.
So, yeah.
But I do know that works, and we do have multiple ways. We have ISDN at the transmitter. We've got POTS codecs at the transmitter site. We have ISDN at the transmitter site, so we can do IP codecs and. Everything's just in place, and it's pretty much a push of a button, and we can get into the systems and reconfigure things. So it's really the way to go. And being in New York City, you have to. You just have to.
What about a little bit different kind of backup? What about backup for the talent? Let's say that somebody can't make it into the studio. Are there ways to get these people on the air from perhaps their home, or maybe they want to take a semi-working vacation? They want to broadcast from somewhere else. I'm thinking of Dr. Joy Brown, or perhaps some of the talent or commentators on Wins. What can you do?
A lot of our talent have ISDN codecs at home. We do that if we get a snow day, and somebody can't get out, or if they just don't want to drive in bad weather.
Hmm.
So. I'd say a good 50% of our talent have something at home, either ISDN or a POTS codec, and we could get them on the air in a pretty hurry. Plus, we also have agreements with talent all over the country. We have people who fill in. You know, if John Gambling in the Morning, for example, is on vacation, we use people out of Philadelphia. So we have ways to get people on the air.
I know that some of the nationally known talent, like that do radio shows, in addition to a lot of also TV shows, people like Sean Hannity has the ability to do his radio show from his home in Long Island. But I was thinking of Howard Stern. I don't think he'd ever does his show without the stripper pole. So I think he has to come into the studio for that.
You know, we should start doing this show with a stripper pole.
That's right.
Oh, Kirk, no, put it back. Oh.
Chris Tarr, your stations are, I think, much more representative of a lot of markets in the U.S. and probably a lot of stations around the world.
I was just going to say, back to reality here.
Yeah, what kind of, probably don't have four hot paths to the transmitter site, do you?
No, we have a couple, though. Yeah. You know, yeah. In fact, when I got to Intercom 6 years ago, there really wasn't anything in terms of redundancy or backup plans. As most of you know, Intercom owns WWL in New Orleans, and that was really a wake-up call for us on emergency planning and things like that. And the reality of it is in markets my size, it really isn't that hard to do with what you've got. You know, there's a lot of ways to kind of make
Absolutely.
Things happen. And, you know, that's what I've done. For example, in Madison, we recently, a couple of years ago, we refurbished all the studios, bought new consoles, things like that. So one of our transmitter sites has a generator, and it's about 40 miles out of town. It's a huge, you know, Super B signal, so it's way out of town. So we took all the old studio equipment up there, built a studio. So we've got an emergency studio right there with generator power. We've got ISDN and internet lines coming in. So we have that situation. Now, in Milwaukee, we have two different places. Actually, we have three different transmitter sites, an auxiliary site that we can go to that has two of the FMs there. And then one of our main FMs is on the north side of town. And I've got a T1 link plus an RF backup link plus an ISDN plus POTS lines. Now there, what I've done is I put in what I call the doomsday box. And it's just basically a server that runs Winamp with all of our imaging and our audio and stuff and just loops. And if for some reason we can't get anything up there, I can hit a button and it'll silence sense first and automatically switch that on the air. So there's something on until we can figure out what to do. We're also fortunate in that our transmitter building is separate from our studio building. It's, you know, way across our parking lot, and it was built as a bomb shelter. So I keep a lot of our backups and spares in there as well. But all of our, you know, all of our audio and commercials are backed up offsite automatically every night. I also have a hot backup, which is a hard drive connected to our server that's actually in a hot swap bay, and I can just pull the hard drive right out as I'm walking out the door. And that has everything. That's got our financials, that's got all of our audio, all of our commercials, all of our documents, all things that I do have off sites of. But if I'm fortunate to be there, that's just a real easy way to grab it, is just walk out the door. So, you know, I grab that and head out the door and I'm on my way. But we, you know, we have ISDN and it's amazing what you can do with some of these old parts that you have laying around the station, how you can build some of these, you know, backup redundant paths and servers and things like that. So, you know, I hear a lot of, well, you know, we're pretty small. We really don't, you know, we don't really have a plan. We don't really do that. But think about it. And if you really think hard and you look in your basement, generally you'll find whatever it is you need to put something together. Even if it's just a Radio Shack mixer and a microphone and a POTS codec, at least you've got your remote studio and you're set to go.
Oh, definitely.
That's exactly what we did in American Samoa when the tsunami hit a couple months ago. Our studio building was not destroyed, but it was flooded. We were on the second floor, and power went out immediately. In fact, there's a video on the YouTube you can find about the FBI office, which is next door to our radio studio. You can see the first tsunami wave coming in, and then the video cuts off because the power went off right then. The power went off to our main transmitter site, which is 1,600 feet above the power generating station in American Samoa, because it's up on the mountain and the power generating station is right where the waves are. So we ended up going to a transmitter site on the other end of the island called Olateli, which I think is Samoan for telephone mountain. And we used a little JK audio mixer and went on the air within about 5 or 6 hours of the tsunami hitting. So,
well, you know, the thing is DSL and cable modems and things are so inexpensive, it's pretty easy to get a fairly low-cost internet connection into a transmitter building. And even if you have a computer there that you can stream audio to, you've got something.
Yeah, yeah. Good point. Hey, let's bring in the guest for our show today, and that's Mr. Larry Fuss. Let's see if he'll answer his cell phone. And we're going to talk to him a little bit about this, the LPFM thing.
Hello.
Hey, Mr. Fuss, you're on the air with Tom Ray, Chris Tarr, and Chris Tobin.
Hey, Larry.
Hey, guys.
Glad to have you with us. Larry, you are talking to us from Mississippi, is that right?
That is correct.
Larry, you and I talked earlier about this low-power FM bill, or this bill that where Congress may direct the FCC to allow more radio stations on the air by telling the FCC to change their rules. Now, disclosure, Larry Fuss and I together own four FM radio stations, two in Mississippi and two in American Samoa. And I don't know if this rule is going to affect us or not in any way. I guess all I could do is make
you don't keep up very well.
No, I don't.
We have one AM and one FM in Mississippi.
Oh, that's right. I keep saying two FMs. Okay. Well, there used to be an FM antenna on the same tower, so.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I haven't taken that one down yet. So Larry, what do you think about the notion of more radio stations, good or bad?
Oh, sure, we need more radio stations. Why not? Eddie Fritz, as you may recall, who was the former chairman of the NAB, once said that the commission would never be satisfied until there was a radio station for every man, woman, and child in the country. And I think that's the direction we're headed.
All right.
More is better.
So,
which is not to be confused with less is more. That's another issue.
Why do so many people lobby the FCC or lobby their congressman to let them put a radio station on?
Well, you may remember back Docket 8090, which started roughly 20 years ago, when the commission, gosh, that was 29 years ago.
Yeah.
Time flies. The purpose back then was to create more radio stations so little small towns could have their own local voice, and people who were previously shut out of radio, minorities and women and so forth, could own new radio stations. And so Docket 8090 created all these new radio stations, which consequently couldn't make any money because at that point there were too many radio stations. And so they all started moving around, and pretty soon half of them were moved into the next biggest town up the road. And even major markets all of a sudden had many more radio stations than they used to, and nobody was making any money, and that's what led to consolidation. Well, then all these big companies come in and take over, and they start cutting local programming because, you know, they've got to satisfy their stockholders. So pretty soon all these radio stations don't have any local programming anymore. They're all just jukeboxes. And so there's another cry for, oh, we need more radio stations for all these small towns. Well, that's what got us in trouble in the first place, was making more radio stations. And so now the solution is, let's make more radio stations.
Now, Larry,
only the government thinks like that.
People would say that you're just protecting your wallet in having that attitude.
No. If you get too many radio stations, none of them are going to be able to survive, which is kind of the position we're in right now. That's why most radio stations don't have any local news anymore, because they don't want to spend the money. Very few radio stations have any kind of local programming anymore. They're all running satellite, or they're running Tom Joyner or Rick and Bubba or whatever, syndicated stuff that's piped in, and it's not local because they can do it and save money. And so if you create more radio stations, all you're doing is diluting the pie even further, which is going to make it even more impossible to do local programming.
Sounds a bit like having too many restaurants in an area that you reach a point where to get any customers at all, they've got to sell food, really offer very cheap food, and you end up not having any fine restaurants. So if you could imagine a scenario like that, not quite the same, but could be similar.
Yeah. Well, the only way any of these little local radio stations are going to do anything, really, is if they're operated as a hobby, because they're not going to be able to make any money. The market is already oversaturated.
So take, for example, the little market that we're in Cleveland, Mississippi. How many radio stations are in that town?
Well, there's actually a total of 8, four of which are off the air. They couldn't make any money.
Okay. And some of those...
We're talking about eight radio stations in a town of 13,000 people.
But half of them are off the air because they went out of business?
Yeah, well, it's a combination of bad management and lack of advertising dollars. But yeah, half of them are off the air.
Yeah. Wow, okay. All right. The other gentlemen on the who are on the show with us, Tom, Chris, and Chris, are in bigger markets. Guys, what are your comments on what Larry has said?
This is Chris in New York. I would agree with him. I mean, you can only saturate the market so much, and it can only support so much in advertising dollars. And we have probably, saturated every market there is in America. And putting a radio station in the pocket of everybody in a market is not going to solve any problems. That's going to create more. And the 1890, I do recall back in the days of when I was doing contract work with some college stations, and they were trying to move around, and that failed miserably.
And I would agree with Chris from the very simple standpoint, and I'll use my pie analogy again. You have one pie. How many times can you slice it before nobody's satisfied with dessert, you know?
Yeah, I think Larry's point about, just everybody gobbling up everybody else from, you can't afford to run a newscast because you got to satisfy the stockholders, or the local programming can't be because of X, Y, and Z. It holds true, because I worked at actually two or three radio stations in a market where a large conglomerate came in and purchased not only two of the radio stations in the market, but also purchased the entertainment venue that all of the radio stations used to buy into every summer and do all the different various events at the summer, the beach, the theater, the whole bit. Well, now this conglomerate owns two radio stations in the market and the venue. Guess what happened to all the contracts with the local radio stations that were participating in the community?
Uh-huh.
Every one of them was canceled. They paid out, they paid all the contracts or whatever penalties it was, and they decided that their radio stations will be exclusive access and to this venue.
Let me take a little bit of a contrarian view here.
Yep.
Because I think we're comparing apples to apple, or apples to oranges rather than apples to apples. But in terms of, you know, some of this competition you're talking about is more like an 80-90 situation. This is a little different in that these LPFMs are simply are nonprofit. They're not going to be trying to get a piece of any pie in terms of revenue, other than maybe some underwriting or things like that. And I think that it's one of those the cream is going to rise to the top of the situation. If you're an LPFM,
a lot of those stations though that a lot of those stations that do this underwriting though, they cross the line and they're actually running real commercials.
Well, I mean aside from that, and I had actually mentioned earlier about, you know, we need to make sure that these people follow the rules. That aside, underwriting aside, you know, the cream is going to rise to the crop here, and or the cream is going to rise to the top. And these stations that aren't doing their job and serving the community and aren't getting the support or whatever are going to go away because they just can't run. But the ones that are going to be able to make a go of it and pay the bills at least with the underwriting or whatever, they're going to get that money because they are doing their job and they are serving some sort of niche here. So, you know, I get what you're saying, and I agree on several levels, but I think on the surface it's not a horrible idea. It's, you know, it's just and it's not – I don't know that it's the direct competition that it's being made out to be in that there's no money changing hands here. You don't have a sales staff going out and selling against the local radio station, which probably is no longer local anyway. Now having said that, there's a lot of, we were talking about the technical issue, and that's where really my concern lies, not as much as the programming or the fact that somebody's going to try a radio station, but technically how it's going to do.
Well, that's the biggest problem, is the technical part. There's no technical enforcement that's properly being executed in many markets as it is now. I know for the stations that I work with, we've had several second-adjacent issues with, if you will, unlicensed broadcasters. And the FCC hasn't done bupkis And their reasoning, I won't even go into because it's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. But they won't do anything. And I'm thinking, wow, low-power FMs aren't properly managed. What happens there?
Well, the FCC's not even policing the full-power commercial stations for the most part for technical violations. So how are they going to police thousands of new LPFMs?
Yeah, and I agree with Chris. I'm concerned that the technical side is where we're going to get burned. Yeah, competition, the editorial side, the programming side, will always the best will filter to the top. That's correct. But I just the technical stuff is just getting out of hand.
Let me add my comment a couple things here. On the one hand, the libertarian in me wants to say, look, if there's room for stations, sure, let people apply for them. May the best man win. And if they can provide programming that's compelling and people listen to them, well, great. They deserve to have listeners and proper underwriting if that's what they're going to do. Fantastic. But what happens in reality is usually, or at least often, a bit different. Someone who's enthusiastic, who is sick and tired of the cookie cutter programming they may hear on their commercial stations, will apply for and get an LPFM license. It's a labor of love, so because they're sure not going to get rich doing it. They're not going to make a living doing it. So they do this labor of love for a while. They may even have compelling programming for a while. They may get the mayor on to talk about it. They may be doing things that the commercial stations should have been doing, especially in terms of local community news and the church league baseball report or the hospital report, things that very few local stations do anymore. But at some point, they're going to get tired of it, and it's going to go back to being a jukebox. The owner of the LPFM is going to put his favorite radio, his favorite music on, or plug his iPod in and put it on shuffle, and away he walks. And then when he feels like it again, he's going to walk back and maybe do another interview.
See, and that's, I completely agree with you, but I think the problem is that's not the message that we're getting across as commercial broadcasters to the FCC about our concerns. It's all about technical, which is the big thing. But, you know, we do come off as looking like we're trying to kill these little guys for competition. And, you know, I think we're not doing a real good job of explaining it's not the competition we're worried about. It's the things, Kirk, that you bring up. It's the, well, you know, okay, if these people are going to do this, we need to get some sort of commitment from them that they're actually going to do this. If they're going to be putting this LPFM on to serve a community, then there better be some rules in place to make sure that they're doing just that. And that, you know,
and make them,
I think
make,
that's the bottom line.
Yeller? Make them put in EAS gear and make them fill out the EEO reports and make them pay ASCAP and BMI like the rest of us have to do and see how long they like doing all that.
Larry, I know one of your jobs is filling out paperwork, and I know that you just recently filed an ownership report for our stations. What was it the FCC wants this year that they didn't want before? Did they want my Social Security number this year or something?
Oh, it's total bullshit. I can say bullshit because this is not broadcast, right?
Yeah, right.
Bleep me if you have to. Okay. But the commission has decided that on ownership reports now, they want not only the name and address of all the owners of the company, but they also want your Social Security number, and they want every individual that owns part of a broadcast station to register and obtain a federal registration number and provide that to the commission. In the past, only the company had to have a federal registration number, but now every single stockholder has to have that. It's Big Brother looking over our shoulder.
And if you have a Social Security number, why do you have to have another one? You already have a federal ID number. I don't get it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's different. The federal registration number is different from your Social Security number. You must have both now if you own a broadcast station because – sorry?
Oh no! I was gonna say I realize that because I'm a ham radio operator, so I already have a federal ID number. But it just puzzles me since you already have one in the Social Security number, and you have to provide it to them anyway. Why they're making you get this other number, which is completely ridiculous?
Well, it's government redundancy. The government loves redundancy, and so now it. To me, it's like an invasion of privacy. The government wants all this stuff from all these people that own radio stations. And I think the speculation on a lot of people's part is this is just another move by the current administration to control another aspect of things that go on in the country. You know, they've already taken over the banks, and they've taken over the car industry. Next is going to be the broadcast industry, and they're going to have your federal registration number, and they know where you live, too.
Larry, if you and I were publishing a little weekly paper in Cleveland, Mississippi. Would we have to submit all that to some agency?
No.
I didn't think so. Just because we're broadcasters with a little 6,000, or I'm sorry, a 3,000-watt FM station.
No, it's 6,000.
Oh, it is? Okay, good. I think it's what we're operating
has been made. Yeah, no, it's licensed for 6,000 watts.
Okay.
The comparison has been made to whoever this new guy is that's head of the FCC. The comparison has been made to Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, who closed down all the country's private radio stations. And I think that's the way, or that's the direction this country's headed.
Well, you know, this is usually an engineering show, and so we usually talk about things that don't go in that direction. But since we have some owners here, that is right. That's what it feels like as an owner.
It's dangerous. It really is dangerous. I think it's part of the government's move to someday eventually control the content of broadcast media.
They're going to have a hard time controlling thousands of new LPFMs, aren't they?
Oh, not at all.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, yeah, because when it comes to registration numbers too,
when it comes to enforcing their idea of what they want, they suddenly find the people and the resources.
Speaking of Venezuela, about 6 months ago, I met a number of broadcasters from Venezuela at the Latin American Broadcast Show, which was it's held every year in Miami, and they were telling me that indeed the government is installing equipment to let them from a central location take over private broadcasters. They haven't as of yet been taking over their airwaves, but now they can. So,
well, they did shut quite a few down though, didn't they?
Shut some down, I think, but yeah. Well, it sounds like we're all kind of negative about this, but maybe there's some consensus
for different
here
for
different reasons that if LPFM broadcasters are made to follow the same rules as regular broadcasters with regard to all the reporting that has to be done, then, you know, I can't find it in my heart to have a problem with it as long as it technically works. But if they're given special set-asides, or if if they don't have to follow certain rules, then I got a problem with that.
In order for me to accept the proposal as add more to the pie, or to the landscape, you're absolutely correct, Kirk. They have to follow the same rules that we do in the sandbox. That's all. You want to operate at lower power, that's fine, but you have to follow the same rules because you're in the sandbox with us. That's all. And that'll definitely determine, the dictator, or you'll know exactly who's going to survive or not.
Let's spend just for our remaining couple of minutes on the subject of pirate broadcasting, people who are operating transmitters illegally. Some people think this is fun. Some people are making money at it. They're publishing a rate card and selling ads, and I've even heard of advertising billboards by the side of the highway that advertise the frequency and moniker of pirate radio stations. Chris and Tom, you're in New York City. I believe you got a few unlicensed operations there.
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do, all over the place. Interesting we should bring this up, though, because, once again, it might have been 3 years ago, Chris, we had the FCC in for one of our SBE meetings.
Yes, it's SBE.
And we had the New York office come in. It was actually quite funny. There were 40 of us from SBE 15 and four of them at the other end of the table. They were kind of sitting around looking and swallowing really hard when the meeting started. They brought up a couple of interesting points, because obviously, pirates were one of the topics, and somebody said, well, why don't you people do something about this? And the FCC said, well, first of all, you're basically looking at almost the whole office sitting here, these four people, for the entire New York metropolitan area. And they said, we don't just do broadcast. We do two-way. We do public safety. We do, and he went down a whole list of all the communication services that they handle. And he says, if there's a pirate, we have to know about it. He says, but we can't just march in. He said, and I just found this interesting. He says, you have a broadcast license. He says, that license allows me to walk into this door anytime, 24/7, that you're on the air. He says, if you're a pirate, I cannot walk in your door. I can knock on the door. I can request to see the equipment. You can refuse and slam the door in my face. He says, now I have to go and get a court order. That takes 30 days. By the time I come back with the court order, the antenna's on the house next door. So I can't look in the house next door. I have to go back to court and get another court order. And by the time I come back, the antennas on the original house, which the court order is no good for anymore. Hmm. He says, this is why it takes us so long.
I still think that's a load of
frustrating. Yeah, I think part of that.
I still think it's a load of bunk because in the Communications Act, I believe it says in order to transmit or do something along those lines, whether it be in land mobile or broadcast, you have to be licensed to do it. And if you're not licensed, you cannot operate. And it doesn't say anything about personal rights. Yeah, I had that argument with the guys from the office.
Well, but in this day and age, you know, where everybody, if you look at them cross-eyed, they sue you.
Well, that's the problem. You know? That's exactly what they told me about the other pirates that I told them. I said, look, we have three pirates that interfere directly with our main signal. And the guy said to me, he goes, look, I'd love to help you out, but those are three churches over there. I'm not going near it. Goodbye.
Well, our station in Hartford, I mean, right up the street from the station, there's a basically it's a church that put up a station illegally. Didn't affect our station. It was right between two other stations in town. You want to talk third adjacent problem. It was the third adjacent to two stations. It was a professional installation. It was a real FM antenna. It wasn't, you know, something somebody made. It was a real broadcast antenna. It had real heliacs on it. It was a real tower that it was mounted on. You know, they stuck a tower up. And it was on the air for 10 years before the FCC could actually come in and do something, all because it was on a church.
Wow.
It's pretty scary, tell you.
Chris Tarr, any unlicensed transmitters in Milwaukee?
You know, actually, as a matter of fact, there are. And the FCC just got around to finding one of them. But the same thing. The guy had been around for years. Mm. And, you know, the FCC finally, it was the same kind of thing. Went to the house, knocked on the door, nobody answered. They had to leave. Come back later, knock on the door, nobody answers. Leave a warning. You know, that kind of thing. And over the course of two or three years, it finally got to the point where they were able to go to court, get the fine, and, you know, and that sort of thing. So, you know, we certainly don't have the problems that we have in like a New York City or from what I hear, you know, Miami, things like that. But, you know, it's a problem that happens everywhere. And, you know, the story is the same. You know, unfortunately, the FCC this day and age can't bust the door in and shut them down anymore.
If I could make an analogy here, you mean if I get in my car without a driver's license and drive down the road, I can't be stopped or investigated or asked to get out of the car or check for drunk driving because I don't have a license I have to have a license for you to check me out.
I think the better analogy is if you're driving that car on your property, as opposed to driving down the road. Now, if the radio station was in a public place, they certainly could take you down and take the stuff away.
Well, if these stations could keep the signal on their own property, then I'd agree with you.
Right. But, I mean, I think it revolves around the laws in terms of the search and not in terms of where the signal goes.
Yeah, the search and seizure laws. Wow. Hey, one last question before we sign off for this week in Radio Tech. Christmas is just around the corner. What would you guys recommend as a Christmas gift for your favorite engineer?
Besides beer?
Stripper pole.
Chris? Well, I just got a Sea Crane internet radio, which is really good.
Yeah. Well, tell us about that, Larry.
Well, it's a little internet Wi-Fi radio, and it's got a database of 15,000 radio stations in it in all kinds of places, Albania and Zanzibar and wherever, and you just twist the dial and find something you like and listen to it.
And this one's from Sea Crane. There are quite a few different internet radios on the market.
Right. I got this one from Sea Crane. I think it was like $150. And it's Wi-Fi, so if you've got Wi-Fi in the house, you can take the radio anywhere in the house and take it out on the patio and listen to your favorite radio station in Zanzibar.
In fact, I was looking over a list of somebody has a list of the best innovations and best CES, Consumer Electronics Show innovations, and in the audio section, a number of those, several of them are Wi-Fi radios. They'll seem to be getting popular nowadays. Kind of does away.
I've got a friend who's got one in his car.
Uh-huh. And it uses uses 3G probably from his
Cell provider. I haven't gotten that far myself yet, but that's intriguing, having a Wi-Fi radio in your car.
Yeah. Yeah. Tom Ray, any ideas for your
The new 2010 American Radio Relay League handbook.
Ah, the ARRL handbook. Great idea.
Because it has a lot of stuff that's can be used for broadcast purposes, and it's very handy when you're looking up something, especially if it's an arcane like propagation question or something. There's a lot of cool stuff in that book.
I'll put show notes. I'll put the links to these in the show notes. I guess that's available from ARRL.org.
That is correct. It's brand new this year. They've updated it. They have a lot of new stuff. It even has some projects in it. So if you know, you want to build an amplifier that's got plans.
Yeah, then you can be a pirate too. Oh, well.
There you go. See? I'm going to go get my eye patch.
Chris Tobin, what do you want for Christmas?
E-reader. That's what I'm looking for.
Oh, an e-reader. Would the Kindle is the obvious choice, or the Sony one, or what?
Not the Sony. It'd probably be the Kindle or possibly the Barnes & Noble Nook. But I currently have one that I purchased some time ago as an early adopter, and it's been working really well. I use it the e-ink. It's really nice. I use it with all my PDF files and all kinds of stuff, and it's very convenient, huh. As well as reading books. But yeah.
What does Mr. Tarr want for Christmas?
Well, I'll tell you what I just bought, which is, I think if you're a geek, you'll love this, is I got a Blu-ray player that has the Netflix streaming built in.
Oh, yeah.
Cool.
And cool. I'll tell you what, it was like a TV coma last weekend. I just sat in my chair and drooled all weekend long as I was just watching show after show after show after show. It was great.
So what kind of Netflix subscription do you have to pay for to get all these streaming shows?
That's it. It's only $8.95.
Okay.
Yeah. I have the Roku. I have the Roku box for Netflix.
Yeah, it's awesome. And you know, the first time around when it first came out, they had a really limited selection. I didn't see anything really that appealed to me, but they've really made some strides on the availability of streaming movies and shows and stuff, and there's a lot out there now.
Hey, Kirk, let me throw out a potential stocking stuffer for your broadcast engineer friends.
Sure.
The Scott Feibusch Tower calendar. That thing is really cool.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Matter of fact, I just ordered one today.
Anybody know the URL for that offhand?
Feibusch.com.
FYBUSH.com. We'll have that in the show notes.
Matter of fact, we're mentioned this week in his on his website.
I'll tell you a funny story. My mother is one of these not in my backyard tower proponents that just hates towers. And so one year I bought a Scott Feibusch calendar and gave it to her for Christmas. She was not amused.
Nice. You're awful. That's terrible.
You didn't put it in her backyard, did you?
No.
Chris Tarr, this Blu-ray player with Netflix streaming built into it, and as Chris Tobin mentioned, the Roku video player box will do this too. Are there free things available as well?
Not that I'm aware of.
Have you seen the Twit Video Network?
I was just watching that tonight.
On your Roku?
Yep.
Okay. And now, do you have to pay for the Netflix subscription to get that?
Actually, I think you can purchase the Roku box independent of a Netflix subscription.
Yes, you can. I just ordered one.
Yeah.
Should be here tomorrow.
But if you have the Netflix subscription, you can also do Amazon Video on Demand. You know, pay for the Amazon Video. Major League Baseball now is offered, and now the Twit Network as well.
Okay.
Yeah, see, now some of that stuff I can stream on that Diversity server that I was talking about last week.
So. Yeah. All right, cool. We'll put show notes to all this. Hey, guys, good show, and thanks for this. It wasn't so technical. It was full of opinions, and that's good. I'm sure we'll get some comment and feedback on this. I want to promo a show coming up in a couple of weeks from now. It'll be on Tort number 11. We're going to have Skip Peasy join us. He is a well-known author, and he's worked for Microsoft. He's worked for National Public Radio, and a lot of folks know him and love him. Skip will be here to talk about Radio DNS, the electronic program guide ideas for us broadcasters to let people know what time things are on. So I think that could be a big help. It would certainly help me to tune into things at the things I forget about, weekend shows especially that I don't remember when the schedule is. So, hey, Larry Fuss, thanks for joining us on this episode. Appreciate it.
Sure, good to be here.
And Tom Ray, thanks for coming in and braving the rain to get home in time to do the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Kirk. And, you know, I really appreciate doing this experiment every time it rains out here. In New York City, what most people don't realize is that cars cannot go through raindrops. It's great.
So you have to wait till it stops raining to get home, huh?
Well, no, you have to dodge through the raindrops, which when it's raining really hard, it becomes really difficult.
That's right. Chris Tobin, you don't have such a problem. I don't think you have a very long drive home in Manhattan, do you?
No, my drive is on a silver limousine known as the Subway.
Uh-huh.
So I do share it with many other commuters. It's entertainment. It's like an amusement park. I pay to go into the park. I get on a ride, and, well, Anything can happen. It's a 13-minute ride, and it's fun times.
Oh, gosh. Christar, you probably do have a four-wheeled vehicle to get around.
I certainly do out in the burbs like this.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thanks for being with us, everybody. We'll do it again next week, and sure appreciate your participation. We'll see you next time on This Week in Radio Tech.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here.
Kirk Harnex wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny Lopez Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.